Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies where we read and discuss foundational texts and key ideas that inform the way we think about organized work today. Talking About Organizations is a community resource graciously supported through contributions by our listeners. To find out more about our program and how you can help, visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com or stick around to the end for more information. Now, on with the show. Welcome to episode 119, where we discuss a seminal work drawn from the famous Hawthorne studies, Fritz Roethlisberger's and William Dixon's 1939 book, Management and the Worker, published by Harvard University Press. To learn more about the text, please go to our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com.
Hi, I'm Sam, calling from Mexico City.
Hi, my name is Miranda, calling from Leamington Spa in the UK.
And this is Tom, calling from Carlisle, Pennsylvania in the United States. And for this month's episode, we are now tackling what I believe to be the largest volume that we have ever covered in a single episode in this program. This is Roethlisberger and Dixon's 1939 book, Management and the Worker. This book covers an extensive period. It's basically the Hawthorne studies, the whole period during the Hawthorne studies. Multiple studies, lots of findings. I'd like to ask Sam to go ahead and introduce us to the book, since this is one that she's wanted to do in this program for quite some time.
Thank you, Tom. Yes, I'm very excited to talk to you guys about this book today. It's an account of a research program conducted by the Western Electric Company, Hawthorne Works in Chicago, and this study took place between 1924 and 1933. And it started as a study to aim to improve worker conditions and kind of understand the dynamic relationships between managers and workers. And as Tom said, this is a very large book. It's over 400 pages. It's divided in five parts. I think something that is really distinctive about this book is that it takes you through the process of experimentation and introducing methods and kind of this incremental way of conducting research of starting with a question and then, you know, finding kind of unexpected results in trying to answer that question, developing new methods to move to the next stage of the study and so on. And it's kind of narrated in this very sequential way. So you start by reading, you know, about their first kind of questions and attempts and experiments. And then the authors tell you about, you know, what worked out, what went wrong, what was unexpected, and then how they use that to propose the next stage of the study. And at the end, we're kind of, you know, overall left with this accumulation of knowledge on, you know, putting attention into the kind of human aspect of organizations, how the authors came to understand the informal aspects of the organization, how there's this understanding of a balance or an equilibrium between, you know, the most economic aspects of the company, which is what was often considered important up to that point. But now they understand, you know, why paying attention to emotions and human relations and how people feel in the organization and how they interact with each other and how that's also very important, not just for efficiency and the economy of the organization, but also for kind of its long-term survival and functioning. I don't know if you guys want to add something else to that kind of very general introduction.
I think one thing that I would like to highlight from a more academic researcher perspective is that I really appreciated the showcasing of the changes in thinking of this sort of starting with an idea of how things should go, being surprised that they went differently and therefore revisiting research questions. I think sometimes in the area of research, there's not enough transparency on this process. And I think it's important, especially for early career researchers and PhD students, to really remember these pieces of work where research went in an unexpected way and there was no shame, there was no hiding these elements. So that's sort of one of the key things that I think was particular and unique about this piece of work.
Yeah, I'll second that because this happened at a time before a lot of understanding of qualitative methodologies. I mean, it wasn't just a matter of studying an organization, trying to figure out what factors contribute to its better performance of its individuals and members, but also how to inquire about the barriers that get in the way. You know, obviously today, 100 years later, almost 100 years later, we are inundated with all sorts of materials at our disposal that have all of the lessons learned of studies like this already embedded in it. This was a lot of discovery learning, and it is all richly detailed. And to me, it was interesting to see how much not only was not knowable to them, but is still interesting now and tends to get overlooked if we don't really pay attention to the details of doing studies of this magnitude. So we'll definitely get into that as we get into the book. Which I'd like to do is just give a very brief overview of what the five parts are. And then we'll kind of tackle them in sequence, because this book is written in a sequence. This is not a topical book. It basically walks you through the entire story from the first study to the last and what happened in between. It's not an easy book to jump around in.
Yeah. And perhaps could we say maybe something short about the authors, which I forgot to mention as well. I think it's worth mentioning, you know, we have two authors in this book, Fritz Jules Rothlisberger, who was an associate professor of industrial research at the Harvard Graduate School of Business Administration. He worked under Elton Mayo. And the other author is William Dixon, who was chief of employee relations research department at the Western Electric Company. So I think, you know, I obviously we don't know to what extent each of the authors kind of contributed to the final writing, but you do see these very simple language, which I really appreciated reading the book. I don't know, I felt like it's written to be a very practical use, right? So it's concern about, you know, it's looking at the problems that I imagine managers and workers at companies would be concerned about. And I think that's partly a reflection of this combination of authors.
Yeah, and it was also reminiscent of Trist and Bamforth, where Trist was the consultant and the investigator, and Bamforth was the co-author who worked on the inside and could help with explaining the setting of the coal mine in that study. Dixon very clearly played an important role in ensuring that the setting of the Hawthorne Works was clear. The purpose was to try to figure out how, you know, what kind of working conditions would help improve efficiency and performance. And of course, the early chapters get into the rich detail of how the Hawthorne plant was organized and why they chose particular groups or departments in order to conduct the experiments. And the kind of experiments that they were doing have varied greatly over the years. But let's just start with part one, which was about the first set of experiments. It actually covers three different test sites, of which there was the first relay assembly test room, the second, and then the mica splitting room. And the first relay assembly test room was the first studies done from 1927 to 1929, in which five operators were set aside in a separate test room, and they were put through a whole series of experiments to see things like rest periods, working hours, combinations of work rest, length of the work week. Over the course of 2 years, at about a month or two at a time, depending on what they were doing, they just said, all right, in this period, you're going to get 2 5-minute breaks. And then they were doing not just comparative analysis of the workers in relation to the environment that they were physically sitting in, but also comparing them to the rest of the department. And in the course of time, they would do things like have interviews with them, how do you feel, and all that sort of thing. What are your attitudes towards the work? What do you think of the rest periods and stuff like that? And in the end, they provided all kinds of data and essentially showed that the information that they were getting was completely contradictory to what they were expecting, which was to say that they were expecting that they would be driven by their individual performance. They would work harder and better under certain conditions that proved not to be the case. And they conclude with some hypotheses on why that was the case. And then off we go to the second relay assembly test room. One of the things that was kind of interesting to them was they were thinking that they introduce rest periods and then they get feedback that says, oh, maybe we'd like more rest periods, maybe one rest period an hour. The rest period feels really good. I feel more energized going in. So then in a later phase, they did 6 rest periods in a day. And it turned out, no, we don't like that so much. It's too disruptive to my work. And so this is why they had to go through so many different tests to see what would make these 5 work better.
I also wanted to add that this was a follow-on from the illumination experiments. So this idea of variations in light that would have a direct impact on worker productivity. And I think that's possibly the part that has always fascinated me about this kind of particular stream of work, that finally a human being is being considered, you know, a human being in its all of its mysteries as a human being, not just sort of a kind of, you know, input output. You put more light in, more productivity will come out. And I think the first chapter also recognizes that quite nicely in terms of, well, the results weren't what we expected, but we discovered we, or at least our interest was triggered by these parts, and therefore we went into it in greater detail.
Yes, I think as you mentioned before, the kind of very honest, transparent, and inductive character of the research, I think it's so refreshing to read and with so much detail. You know, obviously we don't have the books that go into all this detail of like really narrating, you know, what went through, what went wrong, and then how we overcame that, or how that made us kind of rethink our research questions. And so it's really fascinating to, you know, to kind of go through that very rich, honest description throughout the book. I think maybe it's also worth saying something about the company, which I think represented an incredible kind of research opportunity. You know, when the studies kind of began in 1927, the company employed 29,000 workers, which, you know, the authors say represented about 60 nationalities. 75% of the employees were American born, right? And it's also, I think, really interesting to read how they go from studying 5 employees, like Tom mentioned before, to, I believe they say, you know, they ended up studying over 20,000 of those employees, which I think it's really kind of tells you something about the very long incremental process that they kind of followed in conducting this research.
Yeah, and the fact that they, you know, they were able to do this iteratively was important, because each time that they learned something, more questions were raised, and they were able to explain how did they come to the conclusion that another study or another range of studies needed to be done. You know, they went in with the idea of starting with, well, let's introduce rest breaks. And of course, nowadays, how can you have a workplace without rest breaks? We wouldn't even conceive of that. How would they react with the rest breaks? And it was interesting to see how they reacted, which was, I guess, a little bit surprising, but, you know, since it was so novel, it wasn't thought of at the time. They took onto it rather wonderfully and said, oh, the, you know, five minutes was wonderful, but then 5 minutes is not enough because it didn't give me a chance to recuperate. Okay, let's try 10 minutes. And then 10 minutes was too much of a disruption. So let's try more shorter breaks. And it just kept going like that to the point where production did rise for most of the workers, but not all. They found that at the same time, the separation, you know, by isolating these folks in a separate test room, they kind of felt a little bit, I don't want to say isolated from, but somewhat superior to the rest of the department. With these workers being in such tight quarters, there was conflict. They had to replace 2 of the workers about halfway or 2/3 of the way through the experiments. There were a lot of dynamics that came from it. And it wasn't clear to the investigators where those dynamics were coming from and why.
I also wanted to add on that, on these first parts of the experiments, that there's what I think is a very nice combo between the interview data, the comments, the qualitative sort of commentary around the individual participants, which also just gives a sense of the context and what this kind of job is like, but also sort of the more quantitative measures. And I found that a very nice holistic kind of way of approaching the workers under examination, under investigation,
Yeah, those interviews were really fantastic because they did a very good job. I mean, we presume they did an extremely good job of transcribing those interviews. The interview, they published everything verbatim, and it was kind of refreshing to hear from, you know, using their experiences to understand what the interviewers were learning from them, such as it was during this time in which they started to get the sense of the impact of changes in the workplace with the home life. When you shorten the work week, the girls were wondering what to do at the time, but then they figured out what to do at the time. And then when they tried to lengthen the work week again, it was like a new disruption to the individual. Things didn't go back to the way they were. And we talk about that in organizational change nowadays, that once you change something and try to go back to the previous status quo, it doesn't go all the way back. You have changed the environment in such a way that now everybody has different expectations. This, of course, was novel at the time. It was not understood. So then later on, as they started to try to understand what was going on, this is why they had to go to a second set of studies with the second relay assembly group and the MICA splitting group. And I'm sorry, I tried to read the MICA split. I still don't understand what they were actually supposed to be doing. They tried to explain it, but a lot of it was about, they were trying to test the effects of fatigue. You know, is fatigue one of the things that's causing slowdowns in performance or problems with performance? Is it the monotony of the job? They were mining the data, looking to see if monotony was a contributing factor. And everything was inconclusive. Fatigue, the only thing they were able to figure out was, no, fatigue doesn't seem to be a factor. Working longer doesn't seem to be a factor on its own. There's no evidence to support it. But what it was recognized that at some point, the work performance would go down, but they couldn't attribute it to fatigue. So what was it? So then, you know, off we go to another set of experiments to go another 2 years trying to answer those questions.
Yes, it's really cool to read how, you know, every attempt to kind of change these very material or, you know, functional kind of conditions, they kind of generate results or effects that they cannot quite explain. And so they keep going and going. And I think, you know, I'm kind of getting ahead of myself, but once you get to the end of the book, you know, the big answer is kind of focusing on the whole idea of like the social system and the relationships. And so they, you know, they eventually kind of pay attention to something that it's greater than, right? Like the sum of the parts and the kind of conditions that you can very clearly manipulate.
I think also what is interesting in this kind of first part is that there's a lot of attempts to kind of figure out some underlying factors. For instance, with the time or the breaks, you know, what do they actually do with that time? Like, what is it? What do they do when they go home earlier? Like, there's a lot of kind of underlying implications. And I think it's really sort of a testament to a researcher's sort of curiosity of trying to explore all these avenues before piecing it together and coming up with another answer. So I found that part very fascinating in terms of continuous reflection and an understanding of the context.
And how easy it was to do like such like intrusive research back then, because they really get to, right? Like, I mean, we need to say something about that. Because it's not just the length of the research and the fact that they were able to create all of these experiments of like isolating people and, right, like spend 2 years looking at the effects of different kinds of lightning on on how they do their work. But it's also, you know, throughout the book, you see a lot of reference to kind of the physical exams and this inquiry into their personal life outside of the factory. And, right, so I think studies like that today would be quite impossible to kind of get done and, you know, raise a lot of kind of ethical questions. But yes, in this case, it allowed them to have a very kind of holistic understanding of what was going on, I think.
Yeah, it also provided a lot of fodder for self-reflection on the process of doing the research, which was a lot of what followed part one. So part one, you had all of these findings with these three groups, and there was slow recognition that the interviewing process and the process of engaging with the workers was in some way either unfulfilling or it was causing confusion or conflation among different factors in the environment when we were trying to extract data from the participants. And so they devoted an entire part, part two, in refining and studying, it was studying themselves, the interviewing process. How was it that the interviewing was influencing the study, and how could the interviewers engage in the study a little bit differently? The whole idea of an interviewer biasing is something that, of course, we just look for. I mean, it's an inherent part of what we do nowadays to try to minimize that bias. At a time when no knowledge of that was the case, it was just interesting to see how they figured all of that out as they refined the interview process so that the interviewers, they would teach the interviewers to be objective, to be impersonal, to be listening, to not lead questions and all of that, which was really fascinating to read in chapters 8 and 9. At the same time, they went back with all of the interview data and started to mine, okay, during the interviews that were conducted to this point, what were the things that the workers were focused on? What were they complaining about? What were they discussing? And so they went back and did a qualitative analysis of all of the interviews from the two relay assembly test rooms and the mica splitting room. And in chapter 10, they produced a very interesting analysis, and they called it like the urgency. It was the urgency and the tone of the topics raised. You know, what was the topic and what made it the workers want to complain about it, and how much were they complaining about it? And they get into what they meant by complaint in a later chapter. But just to the mind map of what they were complaining about was the table was like 4 pages long, showing all of the things that they were complaining about. And this is where part three comes in, because once they figured out what the workers were complaining about, now it was trying to make sense of it all. And they came up with 3 types of complaints. And this is out of chapter 12. And I thought that this was interesting because I could see some really good utility for this. And I can't say that I've seen a construct, a more contemporary construct that covers this the same way. The first type was things in which they complained about what they saw and touched. It was like the very tactile, you know, we're complaining about the conditions that are, you know, that are really affecting our job. And then the second type, what they call type B, were sensory experiences where there was ambiguity in the meaning, like the room is too hot. It's a sensory experience. The room is too hot. But what does too hot mean? And some people think, you know, hot means such and such a temperature, like you couldn't pin it to a specific temperature. And then the third one, the type C, was more about the interrelations, like somebody is too tough or too harsh or something is unfair. So then they went through and started to unpack all of that and figured out this whole construct of employee dissatisfaction and how the different expressions of dissatisfaction could be characterized in this way, which then would ultimately lead them to doing the bank wiring department test.
Yes, I think something that it's really kind of beautiful to see, you know, from the transition from part one to part two and then part three is you see how the focus of the research changes from trying to control the conditions of the experiments to beginning to understand the workers as a very important key source of information, the workers themselves and kind of their ability to express their experiences and what they were feeling and what was important for them. So yeah, the whole kind of story about the development of the interviewing program and ultimately the creation of the Industrial Research Division in 1929 kind of, you know, shows that kind of shift. And then the book really just starts to focus, like you described, Tom, in trying to make sense of workers' experiences. And, you know, with this special focus on what were the complaints that workers were expressing and how serious were these complaints and, you know, their urgency, their tone, et cetera. But I really loved, I think that's the thing that I loved the most about part two, part three was kind of this shift into, okay, let's understand workers' experiences and what's important and what's, you know, annoying or negative or whatever to their everyday work.
I think in addition to this,
I found particularly important the beginning of the how the interviewing program is introduced, and how what are the reactions from the employees. And you get a sense of a series of employees that are just don't have a space to speak, to voice. And already the possibility of being interviewed and the possibility of speaking about issues was already something, you know, I really like this. I really enjoy this. This is a good idea. And I think, you know, especially when I did my PhD, the sort of the anxiety of not being able to get interview participants, right? Because I don't know, today's era is a little bit different. We perhaps take for granted the arenas where we speak, where we have a voice, whether it be social media or just sort of the general freedom that we benefit from. But this was different. The context was different, and they really needed to speak about these things, and there was no possibility. So I think also that was an important switch in terms of an opening. And then it's sort of as if the floodgates all of a sudden are opened and everything comes out. But I think it's important to bear in mind the context of possibly enforced silence or lack of these arenas. And I think also it's quite fascinating how, if I remember correctly, that part is already framed something along the lines of like the objective or the desire to improve employees' conditions. There's something quite sort of too clearly framed to the advantage of the employees rather than looking at the manager or the business perspective of, you know, let's try and figure out what is the right combination of light so we can save on the electricity bills and so on, for instance.
Yeah, completely. And I think another thing worth mentioning is this kind of distinction that they begin to do between fact and sentiment, and how they ultimately favor more the study of the sentiment, right? Like what's, it's not, it doesn't, you know, we don't look at interviews and complaints just to kind of try to get these pure undeniable facts, but because we care about how workers are experiencing these events, right? So their subjective experience matters, which I think contributes to what you were just saying, Miranda, kind of trying to place more attention on what can benefit the workers.
Yeah, as the parts progress and they start to figure out the high, you know, the things to study for the future test, I thought it was also interesting that in addition to wanting to know more about how individual workers viewed their supervisors, their subordinates, or viewed themselves in the organization, they also were very interested in the relationship between the individual and the interviewer. Because in addition to the folks who were very open and excited about being able to participate and letting their voice heard, there were a measurable percentage of those who were really hostile to the interviewing process, feeling like this was some sort of a threat, like how is my information going to be turned against me? And what they did, and I forget which chapter it's in, but rather than try to summarize that in a whole bunch of cases, they chose four subjects and gave their interview, their personal situations in depth, so that you can appreciate what the interviewers were facing in terms of, in particular, individuals who had reasons to be suspicious of the interviewing process or who were not in some way in favor of the organization and who had a lot to complain about. And this is where perhaps you start to see, oh, maybe the outside of work situation really is vitally important to the workers' attitudes towards work, and we need to investigate that further. Or we need to find why a worker is feeling particularly threatened. And at the same time, they were also highlighting how workers tended to exaggerate their what it was that they were complaining about and tended to obsess over certain things. I don't remember them using the term irrationally, but that might be a way of which we think about it, how we obsess about something in the workplace or in some social situation that doesn't really exist. They were identifying some of those kinds of patterns that they were seeing that they wanted to explore further in the subsequent studies.
I don't know if we want to maybe move this in the conversation before when we started to discuss the interview method, but I think it's, I mean, I don't, I'm a qualitative researcher, so maybe only I found this interesting, but you know, the kind of rules that they create for themselves and how to conduct interviews, which I think kind of you know, really reflect rules that we would think about as valid and important to this day. And these, you know, it's worth mentioning that these rules and these kind of method of interviewing, they develop inductively, right? And they kind of expand, you know, the chapters go into great detail of how they put a lot of effort in kind of refining the method and training others and, you know, creating spaces so that interviewers could share their experiences and perfect their method even more. So they outline 5 rules that interviewers should adhere to. They go, the interviewer should listen to the speaker in a patient and friendly, but intelligently critical manner. The second, the interviewer should not display any kind of authority. Third, the interviewer should not give advice or moral admonition. Fourth, the interviewer should not argue with the speaker. And fifth one, the interviewer should talk or ask questions only under certain conditions to help the person talk, to relieve any fears or anxieties on the part of the speaker, which may be affecting his relation to the interviewer, to praise the interviewee for reporting his thoughts and feelings accurately, to veer the discussion to some topic which has been omitted or neglected, and to discuss implicit assumptions if this is advisable. So I think these are just like beautiful rules, right? I'm tempted to even send them to my students that are starting to learn about qualitative methods because I think they're just really basic and important.
Can I add more sort of existentially? A lot of these are good rules for a general good conversation and being sort of a good listener, right? And an active listener, I think, sort of. But yeah, definitely for interview, but also just general conversational skills and having a good dialogue. I would definitely adhere to these.
Here, here. That makes 3. Okay. Do we want to go on to part 4 then and talk about the last set of studies? Okay. So with all that as backdrop, now we get into the next, well, really the last major set of studies which they did, which was with the bank wiring department. And this was a much more complex situation. We weren't taking a small group of individuals and isolating them and seeing, you know, how different conditions work in them. This is now, we have a much more complex arrangement. So you have wiremen, soldermen, and inspectors. And these different roles or these different people are sort of collected into teams. So it was 3 wiremen, usually 1 solderman, and then there was a bank of inspectors who would check the work. Because they're not homogeneous anymore, now you start to wonder or think about how do people from different occupations, so they were working on different systems, and they were also physically arrayed in the room differently, where one group was in front and another group was in the back. And the social situation was very contentious in this case compared to the previous studies. And so there was a lot to unpack in terms of what it was that was affecting the performance, what was affecting the relation, the interrelationships among individuals, et cetera, some very sharp personality conflicts. But it also raised a lot of questions about norms and how norms of behavior overtook what was the implied rules or expectations of managers. And so that was what the bank wiring department study was about. Yeah, and let me give you an example of what I was talking about here in chapter 18 when they started to go through the incentive systems. And they uncovered in the interviewing process some beliefs. And one of them, for example, in my version, it was page 412, the concept of a day's work and how that drove, not drove is probably not the right word, but how it governed the sense of whether or not somebody was performing appropriately or not. And notice I said appropriately as opposed to the best, because of course, from the organization standpoint, you know, why are we doing this? We're trying to get the maximum output, best performance. And yet there's this sense of what is considered to be a day's work by which a worker feels as though they have done enough and they don't want to do more or don't feel it appropriate to do more. this was something that came up in the interviews, was, and they were interviewing these folks separately, and they may have different concepts about, you know, how much of a, you know, is good for a day's work, but it was actually rather harmonious in a way. There was still this concept such that workers would rather over-report or under-report their actual work in order to make sure that what they were doing was in line with what the socially was considered to be an appropriate amount of work among everybody else, which they found to be totally counterintuitive. The interviewers found to be totally counterintuitive, I should say.
So I think you've kind of jumped to the fifth part of the book, right? About the system of beliefs and the, I think they call it ideological, what's it called again? The ideological organization of the plant. Is that correct?
Yeah. I mean, it's those sorts of things are what they would summarize as the formal, informal, and ideological. Yeah, in chapter 18, I think they were summarizing particular findings independently before they had glommed the broader construct. So the concept of today's work was one, straight line output curves, you know, this idea that it was better to be totally consistent and reliable rather than optimal and maximal.
Well, I think, I mean, you've said some very interesting things about part four. I think I would, you know, what I think this part does for the rest of the book is, you know, we've gone through this process of placing our attention in, you know, the physical observable conditions in which workers are working, and then shifting that attention to the subjective experiences of workers. In this part, we kind of begin to understand the importance of the social dimension and the formation of groups, and how these groups are forming kind of their own little culture, which, you know, they then kind of, I think they refer, they use this concept that is better of informal organization, and how that interacts with the formal organization, and how that kind of group life can also explain some of the things that they're unable to explain by just looking independently to each one of the workers. And I think, if, I don't know if you guys have anything else to say about part four, this is kind of a good transition into the last part of the book, in which they bring forth their theory on thinking about the organization as a social system, as composed of both formal and informal organization, trying to understand informal organization not necessarily as a problem or something bad, but as a necessary part that needs to be studied better. They also begin to talk about this idea of having a balance between the two functions, the two primary functions of the social system, which is, you know, the first one is the one about production, which we're more, back then we were more accustomed to thinking about this. And the other one is about the satisfaction of workers, of the individual members of the organization. I don't know if this happened to you as well, but until you read this last section of the book, I think maybe we should have started, or I would recommend even starting with this section and then going back to the beginning, because then it starts to make sense, right? Why they've taken us through their whole process of experimentation and reformulating questions and hypotheses and shifting their attention to different aspects of the organization. Because I think when you're reading just, you know, from part, like in order from part one to part to the last part, at some point you start wondering, oh my God, when is this going to end, right? If this goes on forever and there's like so much information and so much detail, and it's not until you get to the last part that you go, oh, okay. So now it's really kind of, you know, beautiful to go back to the beginning and read again and appreciate how each one of these steps kind of led them to be able to formulate the, you know, the knowledge that they present in the last section, which, I don't know, it's, to some people it might seem obvious because it's things that we know and we've normalized nowadays. But then I was thinking about, you know, even a conversation I had with a friend a couple of days ago about, you know, he called me to kind of complain about this mess that's going on in his organization, which I will not name. When I was looking at my notes and reading this just before recording the episode, I was like, oh my God, this is like, you know, this is stuff that we might think it's really basic and we've normalized, but it's still things that I think on the day-to-day organizations forget to look at these kind of more human aspects and to really appreciate how looking at the internal functioning of the organization and the social relations and all that is important for the ultimate performance of the organization.
I would also add to that point around the formal organization that in this part, and perhaps we haven't spoken about it sufficiently, but there's also an emphasis on the role of the supervisors and the hierarchy. And I would also add the power dynamics that come naturally in play. So I think what was particularly eye-opening for me was, I think it's among the summaries, the text that sort of summarizes the end of the chapters. There's a part where something fairly obvious, as in you could see it happening in real life, when the foreman entered the room, the behavior of the men underwent a sudden change. They acted as they were supposed to while he was present. And, you know, everybody knows that that is something that would happen if I get observed in my teaching. Yes, I do admit my teaching on that day will be particularly sort of, you know, shiny. The group chief and section chief sided with the men and did not dare to give the foreman an objective account of the facts. It's even doubtful if they could have done so, their own hopes and fears. And I think this is a very precious wording that comes in play, were too much involved. And the foreman remained ignorant of much that was going on. So this idea of not only is there a formal organization, but there's power dynamics in play, situations change and it's normal. And there's an impact where the people, the managers that should know stuff actually don't, because the situation gets distorted. And this is also a little bit, if you want, a reflection of that observation around their decision to conduct the interview methods in a certain way. It's always the same kind of like logics and considerations that come in play. Yes, that is a particular situation where if you create a power dynamic, obviously the interview data will not be what you're actually looking for. So you need to have certain rules and certain principles to observe by. Same thing starts to happen also in these supervisory sort of contexts. And I think perhaps we've sort of skimmed through it quite quickly. One of the initial parts of the book was also commenting on supervisors' conferences. I think the word conferences was used. So already sort of an understanding that there would be moments in time where you would get all the managers and the supervisors together. And there would be in sort of the ambition was to create a little bit of critique on the methods and understand, okay, us as managers, as supervisors, what are we not doing well enough? And I think if I have to imagine the context of that era, I think this is actually quite sort of novel, you know, an admission of we could do better as managers, and then asking the important question of where and how and why could we do better.
And that concludes the episode for today. Thank you for listening. The views expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of their respective organizations or institutions. We hope that you enjoyed the conversation and found it valuable. If so, please consider subscribing through your favorite podcast service and you won't miss an episode. We also welcome your feedback, so if you liked or didn't like something, or have a correction or suggestion for us, please get in touch with us via LinkedIn, Facebook, X, or our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Also, please consider contributing to the program by buying us a coffee at www.buyusacoffee.com/TAOP. That's www.buyusacoffee.com/TAOP. Your support is greatly appreciated, as it allows us to continue providing great conversations about the classics of organization studies. Again, thank you for listening, and we hope to see you for the conclusion of this episode here on Talking About Organizations.